Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now, I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word. So it's a great pleasure today to be joined by Dave McCormick, who has been a member of our Genomics England participant panel since 2017. And was a participant in the 100,000 Genomes Project due to a rare sight condition. Dave is also a lay patient advisor and representative in various groups in the Northwest with the University of Manchester, and has had a successful career across special educational needs and the civil service and other areas, including being a recipient of multiple national awards for special educational needs provision. So it's a great pleasure to have you with us on the pod, Dave. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. It's a great pleasure to be here.
And so today we're going to explore a bit around your experiences in managing a challenging condition and getting healthcare professionals and also scientists both to engage with you and your condition, but also to engage with the wider community around what we can do about this. And we'll also touch on a couple of initiatives that you're launching. But if we start, if that's okay, with understanding about your life story, a bit about your condition, which I'm probably going to mispronounce here, around microanophthalmia and Charles Bonnet syndrome. Really fascinating and I'm sure challenging conditions. But tell us a bit about how that's played out.
Okay, firstly, pronunciation spot on, thank you. Microanophthalmia, as I understand it, it's arrested growth of the eyes in utero. So as you're, I'm sure, aware, the heart, the brain and the eyes are the three main organs that develop first in utero. The eyes stopped growing. And so when I was born, there were various bits in the eye, the key parts, the lens, the retina, the cornea, the actual shape of the eye, all the key parts were either not formed properly or weren't working at all. I have a thing called congenital retinal fold. So the retina, thin piece of light sensitive nerves, a third of a millimetre in thickness, full of photoreceptors, and it was folded, rippled, or otherwise not in good shape. So the right eye has a large retinal band running down the middle of it from the left to the middle. So I have very limited vision in my right eye, hand movements, in fact. The left eye, thankfully, the retina is in a bit better shape, but still not brilliant. So I have working vision in my left eye, but it's still pretty poor, hence the thick glasses, which I wear. Unfortunately, I didn't listen to the advice of my ophthalmologists when they advised me not to take up contact sports, because when you're young and foolish, you think you're indestructible.
Surely not.
Sure, absolutely. So I used to be quite fond of contact sports and all things martial arts. And unfortunately, I zigged when I should have zagged. I got a blow to the back of the head, which then accelerated the sight deterioration in my eyes. Both of my lenses popped from their moorings, as it were, started floating round, glaucoma occurred, pressure pain. Yeah, it was pretty painful. The glaucoma was pretty awful. So they had to remove the lenses. Brilliant timing, just as I was starting my first degree in 91 and 93, respectively, left eye and right eye. Lenses were removed because they were just floating around and causing problems. So I became aphakic with no lenses, so thick glasses to focus through. But I was under the care of a genius, a gentleman who I believe is now retired, Dr. David McLeod for University of Manchester Eye Hospital, and he did an amazing job in arresting the deterioration of the vision, and he managed to give me a good 25-30 years of, you know, the vision that I had, which was still pretty poor, but it wasn't going down. So in 2014, whilst working for a local authority as an education officer in special education needs and transport, my sight started to deteriorate again a little bit. And I discovered that I had a thing called macular atrophy, which is where the central part of the retina is dying off. So I'm going blind. It's a question of not if, but when. Mercifully, thus far, it's deteriorating slowly. But as a result of that, I'm having to use a long cane. We're travelling around outside independently using large print on screen or very large print text-to-speech also. So it's about making the adaptations, and I'm being given the opportunity to make those gradual incremental changes over time rather than a bang, so a big change. So I'm fortunate in that respect.
And through that journey, when did the words DNA and genomics and genetics come into that? When did you first hear those words, or what did they mean to you?
I came across the whole debate around genetics and DNA from two kind of avenues, really. Firstly, it was a personal avenue when my then girlfriend, now wife, and I were going to the local hospital to undertake some genetic counselling because we were considering, we were looking at family planning and considering starting a family. And I wanted to get some clarity on what was going on with my sight condition because it is rare, I'm told. It is an hereditary genetic variation in the relevant genes that deal with sight development. And I was told literally that it was flip a coin, it's 50-50. Any child that we had may have the sight loss or 50% chance that they wouldn't have the condition to develop sight loss. As it's turned out, I have two gorgeous boys, neither of whom have the sight condition. So in both cases, the coin was flipped and it was heads rather than tails in both cases. So very fortunate in that respect. But that doesn't necessarily mean to say that neither of them will be carriers. And that is part of the driving force behind why I subsequently then got involved with the 100,000 Genomes Project for them as well as for me. Because I'm a bit of a dinosaur now, getting a bit long in the tooth. So what's happening with my eyes is happening, but it's more for them and the next generation. The other avenue, which you might be interested in hearing about where I came from, I have been very actively involved in the disability movement previously and promoting the social model of disability and the idea of the identification and removal of barriers to access for all people, regardless of whether they have a disability, long-term illness, mental health condition combination of or not. So it's looking at those barriers and how those barriers can be identified and removed, whether it's attitudinal barriers, financial economic barriers, structural environmental barriers, or the way we provide services. And I've been involved for a number of years now, gosh, must be over 20 years, as a trainer in equalities, diversities and inclusion around the promotion of the social model of disability. And as a result, I was first able to get involved through that work with training at the University of Manchester. And then when I joined the 100,000 Genomes Project back in 2017, March 17, I was invited onto the patient forum through the Manchester Academy for Healthcare Science Scientists Education, or MASI. And from there, I then got the opportunity to join the 100,000 Genomes Project patient participant panel. So that's been my route into the participant panel via the work I've been doing in the Northwest with the MASI Patient Forum. And I'm very fortunate that alongside of the fantastic work, and it's a real honour to be able to work with Genomics England, with yourself and your colleagues, and with the Patient Forum, but also to get involved with the students at the University of Manchester's MSc in Genomic Sciences. And I am their lay patient rep. So I get the opportunity to meet these students recently via two Teams or Zoom. Of course, because everything's in lockdown virtual comms. But it's been a real pleasure to work with those students and deliver training virtually. It's really sharpened up my training skills as opposed to standard face-to-face previously. So I've had the opportunity to develop and co-develop resources with my colleagues on the patient forum and deliver to those students to give that a genuine bona fide patient voice and patient experience to the upcoming genomic scientists, bioinformaticians, genetic counsellors of the next generation. So it's a really important role I have the honour of being involved in regionally in the northwest of England under the fantastic chairship of Lindsay Brown, who's the chair of the MASI Patient Forum, Kate Shaw and the colleagues on the various STP and HTTP courses, as well as the work that I'm doing with the patient participant panel nationally.
That's fantastic. And Dave, it may seem obvious to someone as kind of immersed in this world as you are, but just If we take a step back, why is it so important for people studying for an MSc in genomics, whether that's on the sort of technical side around bioinformatics or whatever, or maybe they're going to go on and become a kind of clinical scientist, why is it so important for them to build into that course this patient voice? What does it bring to them?
Thank you. It's a really good question. And I think really, first and foremostly, it's providing a genuine lived experience, a genuine perspective. You can read lots and lots on the internet and in books. You can learn about, as you say, the technological or the genetic kind of counselling principles and theories. But there's nothing that beats being able to speak to somebody who's had a lived experience, a long-term rare genetic hereditary condition, such as the sight loss that I've got, and be able to get those insights. And, you know, I've been there. I've seen some quite interesting things. I've experienced some very difficult things, as we all do through our lives. But having deteriorating sight loss whilst working your way through school, college and higher education, postgraduate studies, and on to, as you said before in the introduction, careers in local authority, civil service and various things in between. It's being able to show to those experts or trainees in those fields that regardless of whether you have a disability, you can achieve, you can deliver on your dreams and what you want to do. And along the way, you can share your lived experience and give that genuine feedback and approach to support those young people coming up through the ranks. This isn't just about bedside manner. This is about developing a balance between quantitative and qualitative perspective. It isn't just about the data. The data is important, of course it is, but it's also the lived patient experience. Both are key.
It's so important, isn't it? I remember back in the dark ages, I used to work briefly in retail and supermarkets, and you could look at all of the spreadsheets that you wanted and look at all of the kind of customer insight research and so on. But actually going into one of the stores and just watching people walking through the stores, you realize you get that level of insight, which you just never get from the numbers. And it's fantastic that you're able to bring that to the people on the MSc course. And if we think about there's the healthcare world, and you've talked about some inspiring figures who really helped you on that journey. And through the 100,000 Genomes Project, you've also got, and other things, you've also got involved in the research world. And I think if anything, it can almost seem harder for researchers to kind of understand and connect with the outcomes of their research, because it can seem so academic and kind of, you know, quantitative and so on. What was your first contact with the research community?
So contact with the research community, I think, started in 2017 when I joined the 100,000 Genomes Project, and I learned more about it and got really inspired about the importance of raising the public's awareness about the importance of what the 100,000 Genomes Project was trying to achieve, and also to raise the public's awareness about the fact that they had something to contribute, as we've just said before, and patients have something to contribute. So from that work in contact in 2017 and through the work through the Northwest and onto the National Patient Forum, I've had the opportunity to meet really inspiring and visionary people like Professor Sir Mark Caulfield and various people on the GSIP, Genomics England Clinical Implementation Partnership Board, of which I'm a member. And really meeting some passionate and interested people, both from the research side, from the industry side, such as Parker Moss and the great work that he's doing, and really getting the chance to work with, you know, really inspirational leading figures such as Gillian Hastings Ward, our chair for the Patient Forum, and Vivian Perry, our head of engagement, and all of the patient participants, really getting that mix in the pot, getting those different perspectives, those different viewpoints. And I need to emphasise here that the patient participants have been invited on, but they give their range of lived experience. Some of them, like me, are involved in different groups regionally. Others are coming with their own individual lived experience. But nevertheless, whether they're giving their own experiences or experiences on behalf of a child of which they're supporting and representing, it's really, really good to get those views and get that breadth and depth of insight and knowledge in a range of different areas. In my case, sight loss, but there's cancers of all different kinds, there's rare conditions, and there's also the cross-cutting themes as well, of which we all try and give our views and insight where we can.
In those conversations, I guess there must be a sense of the huge opportunity from the research that's being done. I'm guessing there are also some frustrations around either the way it's being done or the speed at which it's being done. Like, what are your reflections on coming into close contact with this world and kind of seeing inside the sausage machine, so to speak, how that's all happening?
I think in response, it's a good question. In response to the question, I would say, like the curate's egg, as they say, it's good in parts. You know, it really is. you know, there's some really innovative patient participation, involvement and engagement work going on across certain GCIP research domains. But obviously, and, you know, no prizes for guessing what I'm going to say next, we would like to see more from the patient participant forum. I would certainly like to see new and innovative ways to reach out to the patient participant community. And if I may, if you'll indulge me, I'll just share with you one of the research projects I've had the honour of developing and co-leading on or co-facilitating with Zan Sargent, the communications manager, and others from Genomics England. And that's the idea that we can use virtual technology, virtual conferencing technology such as Teams or Zoom, to bring the wider patient participant forum into the research environment, into the laboratory, via the magic of Teams or Zoom, and using a webinar and question and answer or Q&A model, which has already been trialed, and credit where it's due, it's already been trialed with within the sight loss community, certainly by the Macular Society and the fantastic work that they're doing. I took that model and developed it and evolved it with the work of another very inspirational gentleman who I've been working with closely, Professor Andrew Webster, who is the research head of the sight loss GCIP research domain. And Andrew and I have come up with this model and finessed it and developed it. And we've called project a DIGVIP, or Digital Inclusion on Genomics with Visually Impaired People. I have to confess, I do like my acronyms, so apologies for that. but DIGVIP, the DIG set webinars, using the webinar platform approach, will give Professor Webster and his team, which are based across the country from a range of different hospitals and eye clinics, including the one I'm attached to with another very inspirational gentleman, Professor Graham Black from the University of Manchester's Retinal Clinic. Professor Webster, Professor Black, and a range of other speakers will be invited every webinar session that's organised to give a half an hour to three quarters of an hour, plain English, straightforward presentation on a particular aspect of sight genomics, sight research, which is taking place. It will be introduced by, I understand, Vivian Perry, Head of Engagement at Genomics England, followed by the presentation given by Professor Webster or one of his team. And then the exciting thing after that is one of three national sight loss charities drawn from the RNIB, the Macular Society or Retina UK, who've kindly given their support and time and promotional resources and technical expertise, will be chairing a half an hour question and answer session immediately after the presentation is given, so that patients from the sight loss community can dial in to the Teams call and send questions through via the chat option or directly in some cases, and have those questions answered in real time by the researcher presenting. And others can view the webinar afterwards if they don't get a chance to see it in real time. And we're hoping that by doing this, we can do one of two things. Firstly, we are hoping to reach a wider audience of patient participants, in this case from the sight loss community, and also who will have their questions answered, but also over time and developing or building that virtual working relationship between the research and the community of sight loss patient participants, the second group can start to work with and co-produce current and future research projects with the first community. In other words, rather than being top-down driven, the DIG Q&A webinar approach is looking to be a bit more bottom-up driven, which I think is quite exciting using this technology. It's simple, it's not rocket science, it's been trialled previously, And the final thing I would say about DigVape is that if it's successful as a working model, we would like through the GCIP board, or I certainly would like through the GCIP board, to promote that model and roll it out across other GCIP research domains beyond site loss. Because at the end of the day, it's very cost effective, it's reasonably quick and easy to organise technically. There are a few blips, and I don't want to tempt fate there with technology, but it's not too bad. And we've been able to identify a platform, a Zoom platform, through the great work of the comms team at Genomics England, to identify a platform that the webinar can run on, which is fully accessible to patient participants with sight loss who are using screen readers or text-to-speech. So that's a really, really important consideration. And we're hoping that, if successful, over the first and a number of webinars we hope to organise through DigVape, that we can then recommend this model to the GCIP board, and it can be rolled out at a snip of the cost to what it normally would on a face-to-face basis for other GCIP research domains.
It's great to hear. And I mean, I guess for all of the trauma that 2020 has brought us, it has brought massive leaps forward in everyone's familiarity with these kind of, both I guess the technologies, but also those ways of interacting with groups. So it really feels like a technology whose time has come, doesn't it?
Oh, I think so. I think we're definitely there with it. But to come back or to conclude your original question, we would like to, that I would like to see more, the patient participants, I'm sure would like to see more engagement with patients from the research community. We recognise that there are challenges. I certainly recognise there are challenges, not least in communicating what the research community, whichever field, they're wanting to promote and communicate to the patient participants. And the use of plain English and the development of lay summaries is something that I and my colleagues are very heavily involved in working with researchers on, to get those messages out clearly and in plain English, but without losing the impact. So we recognise that there are challenges, but we think that over time, things will improve. They are already improving. There's some really exciting dialogue taking place between patient participant community and the research community. And all I can say is, long may it continue, and we need to see more of it and in different ways.
And I'd imagine that if I was a researcher, actually this is extraordinarily powerful for me in a number of ways. One is around, I guess, the it reinforces the mission and the purpose of what you're doing, because it connects it to real life. But even the things like the lay summaries that you mentioned, if you want to understand something, try and explain it to someone else, and then you realize actually that you don't understand it. I'm sure that actually just having the discipline to have to force themselves to think about, how can I explain this in you know, not simple, but in understandable lay terms, I'm sure actually helps drive a lot of intellectual clarity for them as well.
It most certainly does. And if I may, just going back to the work I do as the lay patient rep and trainer with the students on the MSc in genomic sciences at Manchester University, we actually, one of our workshops, which runs for about an hour and 20 minutes, is actually entitled Lay Language.
Right.
And we are equipping those students with the skills and the know-how to interrogate and look at a piece of their own research and how to step that language down into lay language, into plain English, without, most importantly, without losing its impact. And it's a real set of skills. You know, it's not easy, it's not straightforward, but it can be done.
And give us a flavour of that. How do you teach someone to do that? Or what are the techniques that you build into that?
So what we would do, or what we are doing even, is we take samples that have been posted on the web from various academic or medical journals or what have you, and we take an excerpt and we'd say, right, there you go. This one is specifically around genomics research. It could be on, I don't know, looking at a particular aspect of sight loss genomics research, or research around a particular cancer, gastrointestinal, what have you. Here's two or three paragraphs, or even just two or three sentences. Let's have a read of it first. And there's lots of medical jargon, abbreviations, Latin terminology in there. Say, okay, member of the public who's got this condition, your job is to produce a leaflet, a pamphlet, one side of A4, which is taking those three sentences, translate it into plain English. Off you pop, 20 minutes, come back. Let's have a look at what you've done. Let's have a discussion. And it's absolutely fascinating, as you quite rightly said just before, that when you've got students or indeed experts in the field trying to translate a piece of work from their own area of research into plain English, some of them can stumble. It can really get them to pause and take a step back and say, ah, what are we actually trying to say here? What does the word gene mean? What does hemoglobin mean? What is the genome? And how can we articulate that idea, that model, that concept in plain English? Is it a slinky, the child's toy, slinky model? there's a whole range of different ways of explaining a gene. Is it a set of instructions to bake a cake? Could be. So it's trying to take these basic ideas and concepts within genomic sciences and breaking them down, making them accessible, making them understandable. We've seen recently with the various COVID-19 briefings and talks, I can't remember the gentleman's name, but the eminent scientist professor who uses footballing analogies.
Oh, Jonathan Van Tam.
Jonathan Van Tam. JVT, a wonderful speaker, I have to say, very articulate, very animated, and using some really graspable, if that's a word, a very hands-on analogies and metaphors, whether it's footballing or...
The train coming into the station was another classic of his, right? Yeah.
Exactly right. In terms of the vaccine coming over there, absolutely. And we need to see more of that. We really do, without extending the metaphors too much where you get completely lost, but using plain, straightforward English and metaphors, analogies, explanations around the key aspects of genomic sciences that the researcher's author and that Joe Public can understand. And I think that's it's not easy, but it can be done.
It's a great point. And it strikes me, actually, our kids get have a subscription to The Week Junior, which my mum, their grandmum, gets them for Christmas every year. And they actually do a great job in The Week Junior of taking a topic like Brexit or COVID or whatever happens to be in the news, and putting it in language that a smart 9, 10, 11-year-old can understand. And it's a real art form, isn't it? It's great to see it when it's done well.
When it's done well, it's an absolute pleasure to read. And you go, that's, I understand that. No equivocation, no confusion, no misunderstandings. You get it. Bang, bang, bang. Got the main concepts. You've set the context. You've told the reader what it's about. And most importantly, what's in it for them as a member of that particular patient community. It is a sales job at the end of the day. You want to get the Joe Public involved and interested, participate in upcoming research. You have to sell the product, whatever the research might be.
And so we've talked about, you know, the research itself. We've talked about engagement with patient and participant communities. We've talked about kind of lay language and about how digital technologies can help to remove some of the barriers and kind of unlock some of the potential there. If you were to put on your future casting hat, what do you think this could look like in 3, 4, 5 years, if we really get this right? Just kind of paint a picture of what would this look like if it was working really well.
It's a good question. I would say that I had the honour of dialing to a webinar through the I think it was the NIHR people were running a series of presentations recently, and there was a eminent doctor from the Food and Drug Administration from the United States. And she was explaining that in the States, they have a model of a town hall approach. And any research that is going to be commissioned by the FDA, genetic-based research, drug-based research, as part of the process of quality assuring and ensuring that it passes all the regulations before it's authorised for approval and funding, they actually have to organise a town hall or series of town hall events with the local or regional patient community in that area and ask, firstly, give presentations in plain English, explaining what the research is about, and then asking the patient community who've come along and present to say, how would it be for you? How do you think it's going to impact on your life? You know, we've talked to you about the product or the proposed research. We've talked to you about the potential side effects from a, for example, a pharmacogenomics perspective. How is it for you? What do you think? And it's an expert panel of patients who are used to this kind of thing, but it's getting their feedback there and then. And I would love to see that evolved and developed where possible in the future, virtually. So we actually had a kind of virtual town hall meeting with a number of patient participants, with researchers and with people from Genomics England or what have you, all involved. And it would be quite a large event and it would need to be carefully managed. But I think that would be a unique way of combining both the virtual technology with the idea of bringing both of those communities together, the research and the patient participant community together, and really have an exciting dynamic model which could yield some real benefits for researchers going forward, rather than perhaps has been in the past, the research is developed, the product is developed, and then afterwards, oh, we need to talk to the patients. And I'm not suggesting that's happened in every case, but there has been a kind of, we do the research first and then we engage the patients, as opposed to having the patients in at the drafting stage.
Right upstream, right, yeah. Hugely inspiring vision. And I think there's something incredibly powerful about building that into the process, just as a routine thing that takes part that happens every single time, not as some icing on the cake or where we're relying on someone being an inspirational or forward-thinking leader in the field. Fantastic. Dave, I think what an inspiring vision to wrap up on. Just wanted to say a huge thanks again for coming on, and a massive thanks for everything that you're doing in this space across healthcare, across research, across participation, and for everything you're doing with Genomics England. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. And it's been my absolute pleasure to talk to you this evening. And can I just pass on my huge thanks to you and to Genomics England, the fantastic work that you're doing. Keep up the great work, particularly with the fight against the coronavirus, of course, but also the broader research. Keep it up. It's fantastic work. And thank you again.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to the G word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series, and appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G Word.